Strange fits of passion I have known, and I will dare to tell. But in the lover's ear alone, what once to me befell. Today on Sunday Morning Poetry, we're going to explore the third of five Lucy poems. Last week we did I Traveled Among Unknown Men, and the week before that we explored She Walks Among the Untrod Ways. We talked about who Lucy possibly was, or that she wasn't a real person, but just an imaginative creation of this artist trying to explore this feeling that he had and that many of us have in our lives. This poem, Strange Fits of Passion I Have Known, is probably the prime example of one of the central tenets, purposes, aims of Wordsworth's work. And that is the exploration of the human consciousness and the way that a mind associates ideas in a state of excitement. Now, in this poem about a lover who is just walking to the cottage, or he's going on a horseback ride to the cottage of his girlfriend, Lucy. And on this journey, and this is a journey many of us have gone through, where we're traveling, we're walking, we're driving, we're whatever, you know, probably not horseback riding, but maybe, you never know, you know, depending on where you live, to our lover's house. And there is something special about that, especially in the early stages of, I think, an affair. It, you know what I mean? Like a cheating affair, but just a romantic fling, affair, passion, love. And in that state, a weird, odd, terrible feeling comes over the narrator, the speaker. And I think it's something that, whether we acknowledge it in ourselves often or not, we all do experience on some level. I mean, it's very unlikely that you have had a passionate love affair with somebody. And in that moment, in the highest moments, when you're separated, of course, and you're on your way to them, or you're thinking about them, that you haven't thought about losing them. Now, in our modern world, we don't often think, or we don't as often think of death as they did in the 1790s. But it's something that is much more prevalent back then. But we still think of the idea of, you know, what if they leave us? What if something happens that they have to go somewhere else? What if they have to move? You know, what if life takes us in different directions? These are actual things that we all think about. And what if we can't be together? What if she falls in love with someone else? What if, you know, I have to move for whatever? I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that, you know, losing somebody can mean besides death. And then, of course, there is the idea of what if this person dies and I can no longer be with them? But that's the real core of it, is what happens, or what if something happened where I could no longer be with this person? I could no longer experience the joys and the pleasures and the happinesses that I have with being with this person. I think it's something that we all do. And most of us don't consciously tackle the origins and the processes of that association of negative with this high exaltation. So it's something that Wordsworth is tackling here. This is his purpose. This is what he is after, is to understand that association of that strange fit of passion. And it's a strange fit of passion. And that is often, I think, how it's experienced. It's like, it feels like an unsourced, an uncaused emotion. You have no reason to suspect that your lover is going to die, that your lover is going to leave you. I mean, you know, how many times does this cause problems where people don't have any cause to suspect anything of jealousy, and yet it still happens? They still feel it. And this is, I think, an important idea that we're going to be exploring in this poem. And it's present in some of the other poems that we've explored too. One biographical point that might help here, or at least add a little bit layer of understanding in this poem before I read it, is that William Wordsworth had a French lover before the French Revolution, and he had a child with this person. But he had to abandon them because he was British, and the war separated them, and he never saw them again. And so this is something that I think he's playing with during this time period. And this is, he's writing these poems when he's separated from everybody. He's in Germany and he's in an isolated area. There's not even a library. Now, for someone like Wordsworth, a deep reader, that's a big problem, of course. I mean, they didn't have television, you know, they didn't have, and they're not getting regular, you know, posts. They're not getting a lot of newspapers and, you know, things of what's going on in the world. And again, they don't speak the language, so they don't know how to talk to the locals. So they're very isolated. It's him and his sister, Dorothy. And what he ends up doing during this time period is he goes inward and backward. He goes into his own consciousness. He relies on what's there and he traces it, you know, to his youth and to, you know, and youth is he's still a pretty young man, I believe. I don't know the exact age. He's in his mid-20s or so around this era. This is around the 1798 era time. Now, this, like all of his poems, but especially in this poem, there's a very consciously chosen ballad form. This is in Lyrical Ballads, an 1802 version of Lyrical Ballads. This one is published. Now, last time we covered what ballads are, how they worked, why they were important. So I'm not going to cover that too much now, except that, remember, ballads are a story. They're told in simple language. And one of the reasons this is so important to Wordsworth is that he really is and or wants to be the poet of the people. And ballads, traditional ballads, not the intellectual ballads you would get of like a Tennyson, the Lady of Shalott, and many of the ballads that happen after Wordsworth, after Lyrical Ballads, which launches the Romantic movement in Britain. And what you get, and a big part of the purpose is there's the storytelling, but it's done in simple language. It's done in straightforward language, not this highfalutin poetic diction that nobody can, or very few people, just a few fraction of percentage of a society can understand. So he wants to reach the people a little bit more widely. Now, this is still done in a rhythm. It's not free verse. Today, all you get is free verse in poetry, you know, if you want to call it poetry. Most of it I would not really call poetry. It's just kind of random dribbling talk. So, and I obviously don't think very highly of modern poetry or contemporary. So this is blank verse, which is Miltonic. It's in a kind of iambic pentameter. It's in the form that a ballad might take. And this one alternates between four iambs, which is an unstressed and a stressed word. And I'll read an example, an unstressed and a stressed syllable. And what it does is it has the sound or the feeling and the sound of da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. And so the effect of that, especially in this poem, and he does it very well, is the it kind of resonates with the horse beat, the horse hooves. So there's a line that goes hoof after hoof. And that comes toward the end when we've already kind of had the rhythm of that beat into us. So, you know, we'll get something like, when she I loved looked every day fresh as a rose in June. And you can kind of hear that there's like a rhythm there. Obviously, let me just read it normally. When she I loved looked every day fresh as a rose in June. So you could see that there's like a little bit of, you know, there is that that iambs that are coming in there, that stress, unstressed and stressed coming together, give that da-dum, 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 something along those lines. So that's going to be important because there's an emotion, there's a feeling that we've all experienced that I want to, you know, this is the last thing I say before we go into the actual reading of the poem. And the feeling is when you're driving down a street, you know, let's say you're driving down a deserted road and you see those yellow flashing, you know, it seems like it's flashing those yellow lines in the middle of the road, right? And then you see the trees whizzing by you. And it's all very methodical. It's rhythmic. And it's just, you know, everything's just, going and going, and you're getting kind of sleepy and you're getting kind of trance-like. And you've had the experience where you forget like that you're driving for a few seconds or minutes, right? I mean, you've had the experience of getting home and like thinking, wait, how did I just get home? And that is kind of what's going on here, is this narrator is walking, or he's taking a horseback ride. He's riding his horse to his lover's cottage. He fixes his eyes on the moon. And then as he's going in a kind of a trance-like way, he kind of slips into this dreamlike state. And we've all kind of felt that dreamlike state. And it's you know, Freud might call it the unconscious coming to the fore a little bit more, because, or meditation people would say that you lose a little bit of contact with your surroundings and you focus on a single thing. But the point is that he's in this dreamlike state, and then something terrible occurs to him, this emotion of horror and terror occurs to him. And it's a very external cause. And this is what's really important and why I think it's so useful to think about Wordsworth as a philosophical poet in a lot of ways, is because he's interested in trying to figure out the external causes to our internal emotions. Now, so he's trying to give us some kind of association of a physical thing in reality, along with how we actually experience the world with rhythm and rhyme. And, you know, this does rhyme as well, as most ballads do. And this one does rhyme. I just want to make sure. So there's, so anyway, the point is that it goes into the, this kind of rhythm and rhyme that kind of lulls you into sleep, just like the narrator does. So in the simple occurrence is he's walking or on horseback, and he's in this journey. He's focused on the moon, and as the moon descends toward the cottage, and the speaker's consciousness, and this is really important, gradually merges the moon with his lover Lucy in this trance-like reverie. So this is part of what this association comes from, and then we get this conclusion, which you'll see in this idea that he gets in his mind, which is kind of comes during this merging of Lucy and the moon. Okay, so let's go ahead and read the poem, and we'll explore after that a little bit more. Okay, so here we go. And Strange Fits of Passion I Have Known. And this version, I copied and pasted on, if you're watching on Facebook, I copied and pasted a version from the internet that I didn't quite recognize right away, that it's actually slightly different. This is a later version that Wordsworth published. I don't know when, but much later. In the 1802 version, there's slight differences. So I'm going to read the one that's on the screen now, and then we're going to explore a little bit of the differences. And I think that sometimes seeing slight changes that they make can help you understand a poem a little bit deeper. Okay, so it's actually Strange Fits of Passion Have I Known. In the 1802 version, it is I Have Known, which is an interesting change right there, because I Have Known, the earlier version, is more direct and simple for a person to understand. Have I Known is a different structure of the sentence, right? The syntax is different because you have the verb coming before the noun. Have I known? Okay, anyway, so let's go into this. Strange fits of passion have I known, and I will dare to tell. But in the lover's ear alone, what once to me befell. When she I loved looked every day, fresh as a rose in June, I to her cottage bent my way beneath an evening moon. Upon the moon I fixed my eye all over the wide lea. With quickening pace my horse drew nigh those paths so dear to me. And now we reached the orchard plot, and as we climbed the hill, the sinking moon to Lucy's cot came near and nearer still. In one of those sweet dreams I slept, kind nature's gentlest boon, and all the while my eyes I kept on the descending moon. My horse moved on, hoof after hoof. He raised and never stopped. When down behind the cottage roof, at once the bright moon dropped. What fond and wayward thoughts will slide into a lover's head? Oh, mercy, to myself I cried, if Lucy should be dead. So you get a kind of understanding of what is this wild thought that comes into his mind. Is he's on this journey and all of a sudden he starts thinking, what if, like, out of nowhere, it seems he feels like, what if Lucy, what if he arrives at the cottage, knocks on the door and finds her dead? I mean, that is a horrible thought. And I think even if you've had the experience of, you know, traveling to see a lover, and yet you have not thought of her as possibly dying, there's still a strong possibility that you've definitely had the experience of thinking of her as, you know, out of nowhere, she has a change of heart of with you and leaves you and wants to be with somebody else, something along those lines. Or even just that, you know, she has to make an announcement that she's going to call, like if you're in high school, she has to go to college, you know, you're in New York and she's going to be in California. So you're going to have to break up that because of that. So there's, you know, the idea of losing someone, but I wouldn't be surprised if you did have the feeling of out of nowhere, or at least like maybe you haven't consciously made it fully aware that what you're afraid of is just losing her. And the image of her death is right there, but you haven't thought of it, which is something that is a part of life that we just today don't experience as much. So I think it's not as present in our minds as much. The idea that the people that we love are going to die, or that you will, but if you live, the people you know will die. And so you're going to have people taken away from you at some point. And this is in this melancholy state that Wordsworth is in while he's in Germany. This is what's coming to his mind. He's exploring that emotion and, you know, of having something taken away from you during this time period. And, you know, there are postulations that possibly he's thinking in a grotesque or odd, guilty way of his sister, possibly this happening and how he would feel, and he would feel sad about it, of course, but that there's some part of him who would like her to be gone, and, you know, a morbid sense of possibly her dying would be not the worst thing. And the reason is because he wanted to go with Coleridge, but because he was stuck with his sister, he had to help take care of her financially and everything. And so he couldn't afford to go to where Coleridge was, which Coleridge, his best friend, is in a really, you know, popular, is in a college town learning German with all these Germans. And that's where Wordsworth wants to be. Okay. Let's go line by line through this, or quatrain by quatrain. So quatrain are these four lines. It's quatrain, four. So, you know, like I said, this version, which is a later version on the screen, if you're watching on Facebook or on troubadourmag.com, starts, "Strange fits of passion have I known." So he's kind of making a confession here, right? He's saying that, you know, this is a past tense that he's writing about this, or he's talking about this. And he's saying, you know, "I've felt these strange fits of passion." And I think, I mean, so it's so important to try to do a honest recognition of when emotions occur to you, that they're occurring to you. And you have no doubt experienced what seems like causeless emotions. I mean, I can't, you know, name the number of times when you just see something and it just brings up an emotion, like where you all of a sudden get happy, you don't know why, or you all of a sudden, you know, you watch something and I'm thinking of the movie with Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro, like Analyze This. I don't know if it's the first one or Analyze That or something like that, the first or the second one, where Robert De Niro's character, it's like watching, I don't remember what commercial was. Maybe it's a laundry detergent commercial, something silly. And he just bursts out crying. And the whole point is that there's like this seemingly causeless emotion, But there's an actual cause to it. They just have to figure it out. And then they figure it out. It has something to do with like his father, and, you know, he's going to die, and, you know, or he died at a certain age and he's at the same, you know, something very basic and on the surface level. But I have no doubt, if you're a human, that you've experienced something like that, where something out of nowhere just brings you to tears. And it's like, what the heck was that? Right. Or something out of nowhere makes you think something terrible. Or, you know, you're walking at night and there's this normal feeling and you're fine. And then all of a sudden you get a sense of terror, like someone's going to kill you. And there's just these feelings that happen like that, you know, same thing with the lover, you know, and that is, he's talking about these strange fits of passion. It's a fit. It happens for a few minutes, a few seconds, a moment, and then it's gone. And have I known? And then the next line is, and I will dare to tell. So he's going to tell it to somebody. It's not something he normally tells. I will dare to tell. It's like, it's a, you know, that word dare is important. And that, and I will dare to tell, as though he's not something he normally would tell to people, but he's not going to tell it to everybody. Cause what does he say next? But in the lover's ear alone, I have to make a plug for the internet. I think the internet's great, because I took that, I think, in the wrong sense when I first read it. And I took it only as in relation to Lucy. So this is a strange fit of passion that he would tell only to Lucy. And I think that's probably half correct. But the other half, I think that's still relevant here, and that is interested in, that Wordsworth is interested in, is he also means you. If you're a lover, if you've ever been a lover, he will dare to tell to you as a lover what once to me befell. And part of it is, you know, but I think you could take it in a double sense, but we'll talk about why there could be two meanings in this, because we're also going to, I'm going to read you the quatrain that Wordsworth cut. He edited out. And when he did that, it really changes the poem. When we add it in and we look at the total of the poem, it's going to be a very different poem. And that is extremely important in these types of situations, in these types of poems, because it helps us understand the, and it helps us understand what was, why it was published the way it was, and the meaning of it, and the power of these words, that such a few, you know, four extra lines can change everything. Okay, so what once to me befell, and that word befell is a good word here, of course, because, you know, it means a bad occurrence, but it also means befell, you know, it also has the word fell in it, and we get this kind of falling sense in the poem, especially at the end or toward the end. So here's the next quatrain. When she I loved looked every day fresh as a rose in June, I to her cottage bent my way beneath an evening moon. So we find, you know, this is all we find as in terms of why he loves this woman. When she I loved looked every day fresh as a rose in June. Now I do want to read the original publication version, which is, when she I loved was strong and gay and like a rose in June, I to her cottage bent my way beneath the evening moon. So which one do you like more? When she I loved looked every day fresh as a rose in June. So we're going from metaphor to simile. When she I loved, this one's the simile in this version. When she I loved was strong and gay and like a rose in June, like a rose in June. Now, one of the differences is between a metaphor, which is she looked every day fresh as a rose in June. So the main difference between a metaphor and a simile, I think, is that a metaphor is more direct, right? I always think for some reason your hands are like sausages, or the fingers on your hands are like sausages, or the fingers on your hands are sausages. And it's just, There's something a little bit more direct about the metaphoric version versus the similean version. And simileic, I don't know if that's a word, simile, is that, you know, it's like this. So it's kind of, well, it looks like this versus it is this, like, this is what it is. And there's a more direct comparison. So I think that's, you know, he's trying to make a more direct comparison between her. Although in the first line, he does say looked every day fresh as a rose in June. So there, you know, there is still the, you know, it's not direct. Well, I guess that's not true. I should take that back. He just changed from like to as, actually. Like a, now I'm looking at it again. And like a rose in June, fresh as a rose in June. So he's still using, because what really makes a simile is not the like necessarily, but it's having that, I guess, preposition, fresh as, I'm going to have to check my grammar. Comment on my grammar and help me out there. Fresh as a rose in June. So I take that back. He's just changing it. I don't know if you agree. It feels to me more, maybe it's because it's only two letters. Maybe he's doing it just for the rhyme. Because one thing that did struck me when I read this originally, or not right, the meter, when she I loved was strong and gay, it doesn't quite fit as much as when she I loved looked every day. When she I loved was strong and gay. There's just a little bit extra to the first one, and like a rose in June. So I don't want to spend all day on that. You know, it's an interesting thought experiment to see why this poet is kind of changing these rhymes and rhythms around to help. It helps you, I think, to see that in understanding how important meter is and precision, and what a great artist does in terms of trying to pick the right word and the right order in the right way to convey the thought that they want. They're very conscientious. So this is when he loves the lover. This is why he loves the lover. She's fresh as a rose. We don't really get much more about why he loves her, except that she's fresh as a rose, which isn't a bad reason, you know, in terms of relation to this poem. It's not a poem detailing the reasons why he loves her. It's about this strange fit of passion he had. And, you know, she's as fresh as a rose. I to her cottage bent my way. He started going over there beneath an evening moon. So there's this moon, and we don't know if it's a full moon, but it's a moon, and it's an evening moon. And so he's going on his way. Okay, moving on to the next stanza, quatrain. Upon the moon, I fixed my eye all over the wide lea. Now, lea is basically just an open grassy land or area. So he's just walking in this open, you can picture some hills in England. So upon the moon, I fixed my eye all over the wide lea. With quickening pace, my horse drew nigh those paths so dear to me. So we can assume that the paths are dear to him because it's the path of the one that he loves. And we've all experienced this. I remember when I was, I think, 18 years old, I was dating this girl I was really into. And every time, I think she lived like 20 minutes, this is in San Antonio, she lived like 20 minutes away. And I would drive that pretty much every night. And that little route meant a lot to me. And, you know, I kind of loved that route because there was like that bridge. It's like, ooh, I'm getting a little closer. It's like, ooh, there's that store that we went to on our second date. And ooh, there's that. And it's like you kind of see these things and they become these markers on your way toward the one that you love, which is like pleasure and joy and happiness and whatever. And so that, I think, is what he's talking about here. Now, on this way, he's starting to enter into this kind of dreamlike state. He's in this, the moon is, you know, he's fixing his eyes. He's looking at the moon. And it's, you know, it's brightening the whole lea, the whole arable, the whole grassy area. Next quatrain. And now we reached the orchard plot. And as we climbed the hill, the sinking moon to Lucy's cot came near and nearer still. So an orchard plot, of course, is fruit. So it's like a plot, an area. It doesn't say what kind of orchard. It could be an apple orchard. And there's this plot of, you know, fruit trees that is where he's reaching. And this is like one of the markers that is saying, oh, we're almost at Lucy's place. And as, so they're going up. So you have to visualize this speaker on his horse. He's trotting plump, plop, 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 da, dup, 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 right? And that the horse is cloppling, dup, 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 dup. I'm not very good at that, I know. And he's looking at the moon. And so he's going up and the moon is sinking. To Lucy's cot came nearer and nearer still. In one of those sweet dreams I slept, and I think we can see that in two ways, by the way, the sweet dreams is he's going into this trance-like reverie. which we often go to when we're traveling and our minds are starting to shut off because it's so routine, it's so automatized. And he's going on this journey, he's starting to fall asleep or in a trance-like state. But you can also think of that's the feeling of love in a certain sense too. I mean, if you've ever been in deep, passionate love, there is a kind of a sweet dream to it, kind nature's gentlest boon. And that's, you know, I think it's a boon, like a boon, like, you know, a boon harvest. The harvest was a boon. It was a lot of it. It was beneficial. And this, you know, the sweet dream of love and the sweet dream of this trance-like thing is kind nature's gentlest boon. It's efficient, or it's beneficial to you. Now, why is it beneficial? I mean, we'll see. I think that's something to think about. Maybe it's beneficial in teaching you something about yourself. And all the while, my eyes I kept on the descending moon. So he's still walking up, top, 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 top. And then he's going, and the moon is going descending down. My horse moved on, hoof after hoof. He raised and never stopped. So they're still going up. He raised and never stopped, top, 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 top. Went down behind the cottage roof. At once, the bright moon dropped. Now, he changed it to bright moon, I think, to make it more clear what's going on. But the original says, in the 1802 version, it says, actually, my horse moved on, hoof after hoof. He raised and never stopped. Went down behind the cottage roof. At once, the planet dropped. At once, the planet, the bright moon, dropped. Now, I assume he changed it for... at once the bright moon dropped. Maybe there was some meter he was trying to match. I liked the planet one better because we already know it's a moon, and there is something horrifying to this idea of the moon dropping. And, you know, it's interesting that we live in a time when we maybe don't even think about these things anymore, because everything in science, to most of us who aren't, you know, professional scientists, so much in science seems completely settled, obvious. We don't have to even think about it, right? We learn it in elementary or in preschool, and that's it. We know that there's something called gravity, and that somehow holds everything together, and that's it. But, you know, it's really interesting. I don't know if you've ever had this thought, but this actually happened to me a couple of days before I was taking the notes on this. And I, you know, I've read this poem several times in the past, but I was walking my dog. It was late at night. This was in the Bay Area, California. And I mean, it was probably like midnight. It was very dark. It was a half moon. So I just looked up at the moon. It looked cool, but it was one of those moons and it was dark enough in the area where you could see the light, you know, from the sun reflecting on, or however, I assume it's from the sun. I might be that stupid. Maybe it's reflecting off the earth or something. I don't know. But it's like, this is how dumb I am. And, you know, but it's half brightened and then the other half is dark, but you could still see the dark. You could still see the moon, I should say. It wasn't just darkness in and of itself. You could still see the actual planet itself. You could see the object, the total sphere of it. And just half was bright and half was dark. And there just came this thing. I just like looked up at it for a few minutes. I just thought, like, what the hell is keeping that thing? Like, it's just, why did you fall? Like, it's just such a weird thing. Like, it's such a weird feeling, this the world and the universe that we live in and all these laws that we can't see or they operate. And it's like, and just such a weird thing. It's like, wow, like this thing is just sitting there. It's just not, and I could, you know, I could see you. You're not hiding anything. Like, what? And it's just like this weird moment. I don't know if you've ever had moments like that where it's just like, what is this? Like, what is going on? And I think there is something, you know, this is written in 1799 when it's written. And because he sent it in a letter to Coleridge around that time. And it's published in 1802. Newton, you know, obviously you have Copernicus and Galileo and Newton. They're proving all these laws and they're starting, you know, starting to become much more solid. But we're still at a time when it's not, you know, it's now much more solid. More people have already agreed by 1799. You know, we're like 80 years into, you know, after the death of Newton. So it's kind of like you know, it's maybe a little bit more than Einstein is to us, and the way that he's changed the world for us. And, you know, so there's all of a sudden this feeling of more order to the universe, but there's still maybe a glimmer of it's not fully ingrained in the subconscious of every human, that there's still this moment of like, what on earth are you there for? Or why aren't you just dropping whenever you want? And there is this feeling, I think, of awe that we get once in a while when we just stop and look at this. I mean, the stars can have this effect. If you go to a place, you know, on a hill where there's no light pollution, and you look up at the stars and you see how many stars there actually are, you know, you never see like 95% of them unless you go out in the middle of nowhere, you know, and you look up and it's like, whoa. And there is something awe-inspiring. And the word awe, right, which is like this powerful feeling of a sense that there's something more out there than yourself, that there's something that you know, there's more going on than just the world within your own mind, and that you're a part of it, and that's part of you. And so, you know, this narrator here is seeing that and he's feeling it. And then the moon drops, right? It's just like, then all of a sudden the laws of the universe stop. They're over. They're gone. There's no more laws of the universe. And then that moment when the external, and we can imagine that in reality, this could happen, you know, if he's cresting a hill or something, or, you know, he's going over something he's at a certain point and the moon is blocked from his vision. So it's not like it literally drops, obviously, but he has the feeling that it drops. And then that's when the thought comes into his mind. What fond and wayward thoughts, wayward, like random, you know, with a way perhaps, but not a normal way, out of the way, wayward. What fond and wayward thoughts will slide into a lover's head? Oh, mercy, to myself I cried, if Lucy should be dead. So all of this, the horse moving, the narrator, you know, having this problem that he wants to tell us, the moon, the great boon of nature, the cottage roof, the hills, the orchard plots, the fresh as a rose, you know, his woman waiting for him, all of these little images and the feelings and the rhythm, it all adds up to, this is how I got this strange fit of passion, which is this idea that I associated with all these things, particularly the moon. You know, the moon is mentioned over and over and over again. And that's how I got this strange fit of passion of, that Lucy might be dead. And so he's trying to, you know, again, this is that idea of Wordsworth is trying to trace the emotions that we have in a state of excitement. And that's one of his primary purposes as a poet. One of his aims and his goals is to understand that. And that's a very worthy goal, whether he's 100% right, if it's something like this, but he's still, you know, he's going into the mind of somebody. And that's what you have to do, is go into your own mind and think about what external things drudge up internal emotions. Because that is, by the way, Ayn Rand's theory and other people's theories of emotions, that they're not causeless. It's not like they come out of nowhere. We have made observations in our past. We've come to conclusions. We've seen things. Maybe there's an association of, with the analyze this example with the father and the commercial with the son and Robert De Niro didn't realize that he was thinking about himself and his son. You know, it wasn't a clear relation to him at that point, and he was blocking and repressing it. And there's all this stuff where we see a dog on the street, you know, and that dog is held by an owner. And we get a little sad. I mean, the point is that there's some reason that something's triggering and you're just not knowing. You may not be able to trace it very easily, but it's there. It's caused. And that's what he's saying in this poem. And the focus is on the mind. The focus is on the inner world of this person. Now, let's read the part of the poem that was cut So this is an 1815 revision. This is an early draft. The final stanza, this is what was cut out. I told her this. Her laughter light is ringing in my ears. And when I think upon that night, my eyes are dim with tears. So the mystery is almost all gone now in this final stanza. Instead, we have more of a solution. Now we can see what's going on in the poem, you know, in this poem, in terms of, you know, this first line, but in the lover's ear alone, now that really does mean the lover of Lucy or Lucy herself. The lover has indeed died, and the poet is looking back sadly on a night when he had predicted her death. Now we see this a lot with like the Matthew poems, where we get something similar to this, where, for instance, Matthew, who's an old man, is walking by, and he's, you know, on a beautiful April morning, and that beautiful April morning reminds him of a day when he went to the grave of his, you know, like 40 years earlier, when he went to the grave of his daughter who had died years before. And it makes him think of his actual living daughter. So it's like going back and going back, you know, it's like multiple memories all combined into one. And it's all reminded by this beautiful April day, which is exactly like that April day back then. So that, you know, this here, we're getting that same kind of memory of, okay, so the poem, if he were to keep this in, if we were to take this final stanza as part of the poem, that changes the meaning completely, because now it's saying, I told her this, her laughter light. So who is he telling this to? It's the lover's ear alone. So now the lover's ear, you know, in this is now Lucy, and she laughed at it. So think about it this way. In 1799, he went on this horseback ride to Lucy. He had this dream that she was going to die. He gets to her and then he tells her this, and the laughter rings in his ears. So now in 1820, he's thinking back to that night, and now he's crying. His eyes are dim with tears. This is part of the sentimentality of the 1800s. And, you know, especially the romantics. And there's this sense though, that he's thinking back, or we know that he's thinking back, you know, 1820, just making up numbers, 1820, to the night 1799, and Lucy has been dead now for some time. And when I think upon that night, my eyes are dim with tears. So without that stanza, it becomes all about the emotion of feeling her death. Lucy is never really mentioned except by reference to the narrator's emotional experience. So here in this poem, so if we exclude that last stanza, because that last stanza makes this, all of this about her death. It makes this, oh, here's this moment when I was on my way, baby. And I don't know why, but I just was so terrified that I might lose you, that you might be taken from me. And she laughs at him. And then years later, of course, this whole thing is being relayed. He's actually, you know, thinking about it, about her death, about how she died. And Wordsworth's lopping off of that draft conclusion forces the reader to concentrate instead on the operation of the mind. It becomes all about the mind, right? Because it stops here. Oh, mercy, to myself I cried, if Lucy should be dead. He never actually tells her this. She never actually dies in this original poem, or in this final version here. That's without the last stanza. Instead, all of this is focused on not some strange story that he tells his girlfriend who then ends up dead, but rather it's about the inner operations of his mind. This, it's all adds up, or it all leads to this feeling of, oh, mercy, if Lucy should be dead. How? So here's some important questions that without that final stanza, which I don't think are as prevalent. The questions change if the final stanza is included. How did the poet come to associate the moon with his lover, Lucy? What psychological mechanism triggered the sudden fears of her death. How, in brief, do our minds work? That's what he's focused on. If we include this final stanza of him telling her this, and then we find out that she's dead, then again, it feels more like a Matthew poem where we're trying to figure out this sense of a past lover who's died and what it does to our minds, which is still a good poem, but it doesn't stop at, the project that Wordsworth, it diminishes the project Wordsworth is trying to do. His primary purpose is to trace the primary laws of our nature, primarily, chiefly as regards the manner in which we associate ideas in a state of consciousness, or excuse me, excitement. So I want to end with a recommendation to watch Google Susan Boyle's first audition for Britain's Got Talent, because Susan Boyle, who sung, who has one of the most viral YouTube videos of all time, is this frumpy 47-year-old kind of doddering, weird-looking, weird-acting, nervous person who went on this stage for Britain's Got Talent. They made fun of her. They ridiculed her. She had weird, frumpy hair. She talks about never being kissed. She forgets, where she's from when she's on stage because she's so nervous. People in the crowd are rolling their eyes and saying, oh God, what is this? Get off the stage, lady. Everyone's being rude to her. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, when Simon Cowell says, okay, go ahead, she sings I Dream a Dream from Les Miserables, and it rocks the house. Everyone is in tears, they're clapping, and it is a beautiful portrayal of that. Why this is important here is there is a sense that Britain's Got Talent does this regularly. They know this model. They know this emotional framework that we have in our lives that we don't recognize. And that's the sense of awe. And part of that is standing in the sense of something grand and sublime. And that is important for the Wordsworth poems in general and poetry at this time. It's the feeling you get when you stand in front of the Grand Canyon or you look up at the moon and realize that you're part of this universe. And it's like, you just think about it and it's just massive. It's just so grand. Even if you think very highly of yourself, it's still this amazing, grand, great thing that you're a part of. It's just way bigger than you are. It just is. Even if you're great and amazing and wonderful and beautiful, it's still like, it's a moon. It's a whole planet right there and you can see it. Wow, that's crazy. And it's standing up for some reason, or it's staying up there. And you see that with people too. And this is what the Romantics were interested in. I think why it's, romantic, why it's so, and I think the Romantics get confused with only love of nature, but most of them, at least on some level, really expressed and loved man as, Wordsworth put it, the love of nature means the love of man, because man is part of nature. I mean, this is something that was separated later, or some philosophers did, of separating man from nature. And now what man does is unnatural. If we make a power plant, it's unnatural versus, what we are is natural. And there's, when it comes to awe and this feeling of what Wordsworth is trying to do with tracing our inner emotions and exploring our consciousness of man, of himself in particular, and of man in general, is he is trying to express what we feel when we watch Susan Boyle's, I would look at the 7-minute version, 7:42 or something like that, 7:42. Watch that whole thing. You can go to troubadourmag.com. I wrote a post called Awe and Social Media. And if you go to the bottom of that, click on it, there's a video there, and that's the one I'm talking about. But what you get, what's happening there, is you see this external person with her frumpy hair. She's, kind of pudgy. She walks weird. She talks odd, even for British people, even for English people. She, she's just this external thing where it's like she seems silly and slow. And they actually did this again with, they do this all the time with Simon Cowell and that team know what they're doing. And they did it again with a kid who I think was severely autistic, and he can barely talk, he can barely move, and there's like this weird feeling. And then he sits down, and all of a sudden everything, there's a rhythm to it, and it all makes sense. It's all ordered and beautiful, and it sounds amazing. It blows our mind. And what I think is happening is it's a scratching of the surface behind the external into this internal world that is the stuff of romantic art. The inner world is really the stuff of romantic art. And the inner world in relation to the external world, but what's really interesting is the inner world, the way Victor Hugo put it, is that there's one thing grander than the sea, that is the sky. And there is one thing grander than the sky, that is the interior of man's soul. And so there's this feeling that once in a while we get glimpses of, because most of us, that most of us think other people are facile, flat. There's just, we get little tastes of them, and maybe we think there's a little bit of depth to them, but we don't really get a sense of it. But when we see something like the Susan Boyle performance, we start to see that, we see a little hill, and then the next day it's a mountain that's actually a volcano that's erupting. Like, and this is something that volcanoes can do, is like they could start off this thing and then they explode and they're this big volcano. And that's how humans are, is that we're like this little bump. And that's what we see. But really, iceberg is another example, right? We see this iceberg and really all of the stuff is underneath. And that's true. But to see that with Susan Boyle, to see that with this autistic kid, that is the emotion that when you feel what you feel during those moments, when that happens, especially the first time you experience seeing Susan Boyle's performance, that is awe in humans. And that is the stuff of William Wordsworth. Okay, we'll see you next time.